This is Radio Ego Shock with Alex Smith.
When crazy weather goes on and on, we worry, is this the new normal? Later in this program, climate scientist Paul Beckwith explains why there is no new normal. We should expect extremes, swings, difficulties and changes as the world warms. But first, this. Even as millions of Americans feel beaten up and robbed by storms, many do not know extreme spring weather may be part of the climate crisis. Is that because of scientific caution, or is it a breakdown in critical information? And what if even experts can feel shut out? Welcome to the complex world. Trained in the South, American meteorologist Richard Rood bridges that gap between weather and climate. Richard teaches master's-level postgrads while a professor of climate research at the University of Michigan. Dr. Rood is author or co-author of over 100 peer-reviewed papers and the book Demystifying Climate Models, A User's Guide to Earth Systems Models. He also publishes articles at The Conversation. From Colorado, Richard Rood, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for asking me.
Speaking about recent extremes in storms and flooding in mid to eastern America, you told USA Today it is extraordinarily unlikely that this is just a set of typical weather events that just happens to occur at the same time. What leads you to that conclusion?
If you look at the most robust expectations of climate change, is that the temperature will rise on average, and with that temperature rise, there will be an increase of water vapor in the atmosphere. And what people need to understand about water vapor is that it represents energy at some level. It's the energy to evaporate it, and when it changes from vapor back to rain or snow, it releases energy. So we're putting a lot of energy into the atmosphere, and that energy has to have an effect in some way or another. It's extraordinarily difficult to imagine any way that such energy would not have an effect on weather. So when you have this background of more moisture and more heat, you would expect to see large accumulations of effects, such as spring coming earlier. You would expect to see sort of regional scale events. You would not just be looking at one event that had extreme precipitation, but you would be seeing a larger and larger percentage of the events having extreme precipitation. So if you look at the precipitation in the United States alone in the last year or so, it's been an extraordinarily wet year. If you look at the floods right now, we've had flooding from, you know, Texas up through the Red River of the North, and we're currently having record flooding in the Great Lakes. At the same time, we just had this extraordinary heat wave in Georgia and in the southeast, which is under also a growing drought all of a sudden. So when you start looking at the coherence and the convergence of all this information together, that's why you can come to this conclusion that this is not just an extraordinary coincidence. And then to extend that, look around the world at what's happening at flooding in other places.
And the multitude of tornadoes in the recent U.S. string of storms is really shocking. And since the year 2000, Earth is seeing a new pattern in tornadoes not seen since 1960. You know, a single tornado may not be record-setting. We may still get several years between the big number tornadoes, but clustered outbreaks of tornadoes may be another unexpected side effect of global warming, some scientists say. What do you think, Richard?
When I think about tornadoes, tornadoes are an event that's very small scale, and there's a number of things that happen that have to come together in order to get the exact environment in which a tornado occurs. And it's very small scale, and the connections to climate would be indirect, let's say. If you look at one of the ways that Steve Schneider used to talk about how to think about climate knowledge and the state of the knowledge, he and Richard Moss broke that into four types: well-established, established but incomplete, there are competing explanations, or it remains speculative. And I would have to say that with regard to tornadoes and climate change, we're somewhere down there between speculative and there are competing explanations. We have pretty strong evidence at this point that in recent years we have seen changes in characteristics of tornadoes. We've seen these clusters, the numbers of them. But if you imagine the environment in which tornadoes could occur, which climate change, there are some aspects of climate change which would perhaps make that environment more ripe, such as the heat, the moisture increases I mentioned earlier, but there are other aspects, such as how the wind varies with altitude, that climate change might make less likely for a particular type of tornadoes. But if you think of that environment and you think of tornadoes, the real thing that's trying to happen here, which is the atmosphere is trying to deal with energy imbalances, then what you will see is even if you're at tornadoes, the tornadoes, there could be large swarms of small tornadoes. There could be very large, intense tornadoes with very high winds, or there could be some type of tornado that has a larger spatial scale and perhaps somewhat smaller wind. And there are all ways of dealing with these energy imbalances. And I think what we can start to say right now is we're seeing some differences in the characteristics of tornadoes than we've seen in the past. One of those is potentially this clustering. But I think more to the point for climate change, there's some evidence that what we've traditionally talked about as Tornado Alley might be migrating a little bit more to the east and more tornadoes potentially in the south. And that sort of change in the positioning is more directly related to large-scale circulations that you might associate with climate change. So I think it's very hard to come up with cause and effect. However, I think one would expect that the characteristics of tornadoes would change, and I think it's reasonable to say that we might be seeing that at this point.
It seems to me, though, that these unexpected results of a heating planet seem to pop up sooner than those events that scientists could be confident in with easy-to-prove climate causes. A recent EcoShock guest provided another one. Even when heat records are not set, back-to-back heat waves are increasing in the instrumental record since the year 2000. So these sideways impacts say that climate change is not easy for most of us to grasp. Richard, is it easier for you?
Well, I've been immersed in it for some time, and I live and think about the complexity of climate change and perhaps how to communicate it more effectively. Is it easy? No. Part of the reasons it's not easy to explain, and part of the reasons that it's, you know, a challenge in the scientific community is that there are a lot of apparent contradictions. But when you think about the communication of climate change, it would be far easier if there was, say, one record extreme set after another, which is not the case, and we shouldn't expect that to be the case. What we're expecting to see is that if you take a population or if you take a series of events, that there are more events that are extreme in some way or another. So you mentioned heat waves. So we would expect to see that there would be more heat waves. We would not necessarily expect to see that each heat wave is more intense by some measure than the past one. So I think one of the real problems that climate scientists have faced, and as well as those who try to communicate climate science, is that the basic physics is really fairly simple, energy balance physics. It's in a very complex system. And communication-wise, we often think to find really simple, perhaps metaphors or similes to explain these things. And while they are useful, they're all limited because we continue to avoid the complexity. So I think the sort of the sweet spot is to think about how do you communicate that complexity in such a way that it's meaningful, but not oversimplify it into a black and white sort of picture, which is not at all what we have here.
Richard Rood, you've written about climate models. Do weather models and climate models share a lot, and do they talk to each other?
At some level, that's part of my career. I have developed components that are used in both climate and weather models. And one of the interesting things to me as I was working at NASA in the 1990s was that the weather models and the climate models, you know, really are different applications of the same equations. And they do, let's say, talk to each other, but the fields evolved differently. They evolved with different purposes in mind. And so naturally, they each develop their own approaches and their own cultures. But there is, I think, one very important difference between climate and weather models, which is a weather model is trying to take an observed state of the atmosphere and the ocean and the land and project that forward in a way that is rather immediately useful, whereas a climate model is responding more to changes in the environment, such as the increasing CO2 and perhaps changes in the land surface as we alter forests and agricultural fields. So their purpose was different. And the way I like to think about this problem, there are some very important gaps right now between weather and climate science. And the way I view those gaps is that they are giving us information about the physics that we need to understand better. And I think a lot of that is, in fact, going on right now.
For a couple of decades, meteorologists and climate scientists barely spoke. There was almost a competition for funding and attention. Did we make a fundamental mistake early on by so thoroughly separating meteorology and climate science?
I think that's a really interesting historical and perhaps philosophical question. If you go back and look at the history, and a history that I would recommend is actually by my colleague Paul Edwards, who is a historian of weather and climate science. One of the things that you see is that meteorology had direct commercial applications. And because of that, because of European colonialism, the need to know about states of the weather at sea for commerce, there was a lot of attention placed in meteorology and prediction. And as early as the 20th century, we were trying to do numerical modeling to do prediction. And at the same time, if you look at the history where climate emerged, it was often gentlemen scientists at some level who were going to try to understand the glaciers and making great expeditions to extreme parts of the world in the tropics and the poles. So I don't think you can say there was an intent and a mistake. I think that what you saw is sort of a natural evolution. World War II, and obviously World War I, but World War II, because we were beginning to advance more in our understanding of the numerical approaches, World War II was a huge advance in weather modeling because of the immediate need of it for, obviously, combat operations. And so there are a lot of things that drive forward weather modeling. It was not until we really started thinking seriously about the role of climate change that climate, you know, moved out of sort of that curiosity of the casual science and started to move into it having societal relevance and there being a use, and we might have this use-driven research. So we evolved in the 60s and 70s to have the oceanographers part of it, the climatologists part of it, the glaciologists part of it. They all had different fields, different funding, and It's a rather natural attribute of how these fields emerge out of, you know, this historical context, that they compete for funding because there's limited funding that's shared amongst the natural sciences. So I don't think it's right to say that it was an actual mistake, but it's been extraordinarily difficult to break down the stovepipes and to move into what we would call multidisciplinary modeling or integrative modeling or comprehensive modeling. And part of that is this history. It's really interesting to think about how, you know, meteorology essentially defined the definition of climate for a long time as 30-year average of weather. And when you start to really think about climate, that's not even an especially good definition of climate, because climate is really more about the ocean and the ice state. So there are big sort of cultural artifacts, I would call them, that come from this history.
Well, plus, we can't really call climate a 30-year history of weather when the history of weather is changing so rapidly. We don't have a normal to balance that. But that's another whole topic. I have to get this in. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is scientist Richard Rood, a veteran meteorologist and climate tracker from the University of Michigan. So, Richard, you thought I might balk at your specialty of climate informatics. We will dive into that deep end. It might be foolhardy, but what I'm getting from this is that the satellites and the great models are churning out data and reports, vast amounts of it about the world, and some of that data flow and the models attempt to be transparent. They try to offer access to the public. How is that working out?
It's another, I guess, you know, issue of complexity at some level or another of how it's working out. I think that you can make an argument that climate science, and to the same sort of argument, weather science, because of its strong societal need and the potential impacts that might come from the science on society, has made an effort to be transparent and to make data and to make information available. And if we look at the digital information associated with that, huge portions of both the observational and the simulation databases are formally publicly available. You can find places where, in theory, you can access them. But how to use that data, how to get that data, how to manage that data, how to analyze that data is an enormously difficult problem. When we started this in the mid-1990s, there was this idea that NASA, for example, which had a climate mission called the Earth Observing System that actually was first proposed by the first President Bush, was going to make all of their data available. I think I was a PI in that program within 72 hours of the time it being observed. And NASA was taking a lot of data, and they imagined them defining standards and services. And in the mid-90s, that was not completely crazy. But before you could get agreement on the language, on the standards and services, the technology has changed. And so we got to this point that this idea that the data providers were going to also provide the service to accommodate an incredibly diverse community of users, which each had their own language, they had their own technology, that did not work out so well. And so we started to move to this idea that there needed to be co-development of data systems that considered the specifics of the end users in their design, in their testing. And that idea of co-development and the idea of what actually needs to be in the data system is still something that's emerging right now. You can look and see there are a lot of interesting data services out there, but there are some really fundamental challenges with climate data or weather data. One is its complexity, but part of it is that it's not static. Once you take even an observed data set, there are complex models used in, you know, deriving, you know, you can think of how you might measure even sea surface temperature. And, you know, you can probably think of four or five ways that you might measure it if, you know, you were out in a boat and wanted to know the temperature of the water. And then you collect all this data, and then you realize that maybe it's, you know, you're collecting data from a different level. You know, you're collecting it 1 feet and somebody else collecting it 2, or you might be throwing it off the back of your boat into your engine exhaust or something like that. So you come up with these quality control issues. And so the climate data, even once it's taken, is not static. It's always having quality control considerations. And so while it is transparent, it's not always what we would say it's especially usable. It was interesting when we were teaching informatics, again, with my colleague Paul Edwards, who I mentioned earlier as a historian, we actually did surveys of government data systems. And one of the things that we found that was most important for any user was whether it was a glossary of terms that they could actually understand in their field or in their expertise space of what to do. And then if you start thinking about developing glossaries, and there have been massive efforts to develop glossaries to describe climate models, each modeling group uses the words differently. And it's just an enormously complex task, especially if you imagine a one-size-fits-all for all public and professional use of data. So it's a mixed bag. It's transparent. There's nothing being hidden, but its usability is often very low.
Well, I'm going to have to wrap this subject up in this way by saying that your book, Demystifying Climate Models, has been opened up as a free electronic book by Springer, and I'll put links to that in my EcoShock blog. And also that listeners, for the meantime, can use earthnullschool.net and climatereanalyzer.org to get at least some close to real-time picture of what's going on the Earth while we wait for a clearer and more simpler system to be available to us armchair scientists. So meantime, Richard, you're trained as a meteorologist. Do you keep track of what the American Meteorological Society is saying about the links between climate change and extreme weather?
The short answer is yes. I'm a member, an active member of the American Meteorological Society. I was not involved in the rewriting of their draft informational statement. The society regularly updates their statements over the years, and they have a new 2019 statement, which is actually quite comprehensive, and it's a nice, clear explanation, I think, of the state of the science in a limited number of words. So yes, I do, and I congratulate and admire the people who put effort into what I think is a very good statement.
Yes, I think there's been a lot of progress from that society in the last 10 years of really getting the climate links in there. Now, this isn't a scientific question, but why do you think the major television networks failed to mention climate change during more than a month and a half of nightly news coverage of flooded farms and towns and storm wreckage?
That's an interesting question. Of course, I don't know exactly what is in the mind of the news editor and what they're putting out there. I feel as if, you know, at one level, you know, there's a certain demand of the news cycle, and I think actually one of the perhaps even political tactics of what's going on in the United States right now is to create this sort of distracting chaos that keeps people from looking at what's going on under the hood. I think there's also a certain level of climate fatigue in terms of, you know, here's this constant march and mantra of what's happening with the Earth. Thinking about it just from my perspective, you know, I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with the Wall Street Journal. I, actually far less than some of my colleagues, anytime we do an interview that reaches out of sort of the choir, you know, that's interested in climate change, you know, we get harassing emails. And I'm sure that that ultimately takes a toll on a weather station from their listeners, you know, when they talk about climate change, that they get some harassment and they get tired of it. And, you know, I know a number of TV meteorologists who are very hard working on trying to get climate into their news stories. And I know they receive resistance from some users. They receive support from some users. And I'm pretty certain that they probably also receive some feedback from certain advertisers. So I think it's a complex question. And I think there are probably numerous attributes of why it might appear to be underreported. And it probably is underreported.
You put out an interesting article called Human Experts and the End-to-End System. Can you just give us a nutshell snapshot? What were you trying to say in that article?
So that goes back to this idea of the data systems and it being open and transparent. And when that was originally posed and these data systems that were going to make data available, and the social scientists I work with call that putting data on the loading dock. Putting it on the loading dock does not mean that somebody can then take that data and turn it into something useful. They need information on how to use that data. They need information on this sort of complete chain of that comes from behavioral science and information science and climate science and then the specialties in which they work, for instance, epidemiology, on how to translate and fix that or make that data salient to their problems. And what we found in when we were doing our informatics courses is that it's really beyond what we can do right now to just simply put data on a loading dock and make it available. Go back to that example I gave about, you know, the sea surface temperature and perhaps the need to be updating that because of collection techniques or analysis techniques or instrument types. And to find that out, you need humans. So what we found was that you needed this, what we would call an occupational class of climate interpreters or climate translators who would sit between the data providers and the data users and know some of these idiosyncratic issues of suitability for application, quality control, you name it. And in fact, you know, you mentioned in the introduction that I teach these master's level postgraduates. My goal in that program, or our goal in that program, is to be developing these translators and interpreters. And so that's what we were getting at. We are not at a place where we can just simply put data out there and expect it to be generally usable.
We live directly in the weather day to day. Can we say truthfully that weather is becoming a more scary place because of changes to the atmosphere?
I think that we can say that the weather is changing, that in many places, many times, many instances right now, surprises are emerging. We definitely are at a time where our infrastructure, our design that we've used in the past, they are being stressed not only by the fact that they're getting, in many cases, old and cranky on their own, but they're seeing new extremes in precipitation. If you look at urban flooding, you look at a place like Ellicott City, Maryland, has had 2 500-year floods in the last 5 years. You look at things like Hurricane Floyd in North Carolina in the late 90s and then followed by Matthew and Florence, and you look at Harvey. You look at these storms that have this immense amount of precipitation that's flooding entire states or large subsections of states. I think you have to say that the weather is changing in a way that in many instances increasing risks, and it is frightening, and I actually occasionally get calls from people who are just simply scared about how to deal with this and what's coming.
I may be one of those people calling you. Sadly, we're out of time for this conversation. We have been speaking with Dr. Richard Rood from the University of Michigan, and you can find links to his bio information, his science, and his latest article in the conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Richard, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're welcome, and thank you for asking me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Climate truth is breaking into the mainstream. Like this headline from USA Today, "End of Civilization, Climate Change Apocalypse could start by 2050 if we don't act." Sure, it's just one blip buried in celebrity news and the Donald Trump show, but still, maybe soon they will hear about Radio EcoShock and Paul Beckwith. Paul is a regular correspondent here. He is the Canadian climate scientist who set out to educate the world via YouTube. As recent extreme weather reveals the nasty side of climate change, it's time to get Paul's assessment. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Hey, Paul, when I saw you writing humanity's tombstone inscription in a YouTube video title, I thought, uh-oh, maybe I better check in with Paul. Are you doing okay?
Yes, personally, I'm doing great. You know, it's nice to finally get some warm weather. We've had a very, very cold spring in Ottawa, like many places, and lots of rain. Finally, it's going to be 26, 27 on the weekend. Don't tell that to people in India, though, right, who are suffering, you know, the whole country suffering over 50 degrees Celsius temperatures.
Yeah, well, we'll get more into that as we get going here. You have lots of company now, Paul, as big papers like the New York Times, USA Today, and The Guardian in the UK are starting to report on the developing climate disaster. But behind that news, Mark Kaufman at Mashable jolted me with some basics. It's not just that we're adding billions of tons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere again this year. We are doing it faster. And he writes, quote, "After the Scripps monitoring station atop Hawaii's towering Mauna Loa went online in 1959, CO2 rose around just 0.7 parts per million per year in the early decades of operation. Then in the 1990s, the rate increased to 1.5 parts per million per year. The last decade has averaged 2.2 parts per million. Yet in the last year, 2018, it was 3.5 parts per million gain. Concentrations of the planet's most influential greenhouse gas are accelerating," end quote from Mark Kaufman. So to me, Paul, that's the scariest news of all. We are literally hitting the gas pedal as we drive off the cliff. Isn't that what is behind everything else we talk about?
Yes, you know, that Keeling curve showing the CO2 fluctuation, it's recorded each day, so day to day or even, you know, hourly. But that's really the curve that is behind everything. I mean, those levels have been accelerating at ever faster rates. You know, we have many years now that are over the 3 parts per million gain per year. As you said, 3.5 sets a record. And yeah, we have to bend that curve over. We have to get CO2 levels in the atmosphere back down to stable levels. And some people have said 350. That started the organization 350.org. And, you know, many people, including the Healthy Climate Alliance, are arguing that to stabilize climate, we need to get about the 300 level. That needs to be the target. So the big question is, you know, how do we do that? Are we even capable of doing that? And it's not just CO2, it's, you know, methane is on a tear as well. We're setting new records, and also nitrous oxide is accelerating upwards too. All of these greenhouse gases that are key, they're accelerating upward. They're not just rising at constant rates even.
You, Paul Beckwith, are really kind of a pioneer in the science of abrupt climate change. I know you considered doing a PhD thesis just on that, but you got swept away by the torrent of evidence and science. Is an abrupt climate shift already underway?
Yes, it is. It's well underway. You know, think of it as, you know, we generally had a stable climate before with a linear rise in all of the parameters of climate, whether it be surface temperatures, ocean temperatures, CO2 levels, you know, disruption to weather patterns, et cetera. It was sort of, you know, a linear increase. And then the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change would make projections saying, well, it's going to stay linear. But clearly, we've notched up. The slope of the curve has gone almost vertical, and we're rapidly accelerating to a much warmer world. And eventually, we'll reach this state. You know, the final state that we're heading for is one without snow and ice in the Arctic, completely open Arctic Ocean year-round. Sea level rise still notching up rapidly because the melt from Greenland, which is will be the only ice-covered region left in the Arctic soon. There'll be no more sea ice, you know, will be exposed. And so we're heading up to this much, much warmer planet. Of course, with no ice covering the Arctic Ocean, the jet streams will be completely rewired, configured to something different, you know, be much weaker. And we're going to be in a more monsoonal world where weather patterns on continents everywhere, including in the Arctic, are affected more by the land-ocean contrast that will occur. So there's no new normal. I mean, people say that new normal. The CBC was asking me about the tornado that hit Ottawa recently, and, you know, is this going to be a new normal, more tornadoes? And I said, you know, I really emphasize that there's no new normal. We're undergoing abrupt climate change. We're going to see huge, rapid changes. We've only basically seen the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. We haven't seen anything yet. Extreme weather events are greatly increasing in frequency, severity, and duration, and they're happening in locations that we don't expect. I mean, the torrential rains around the world are just phenomenal. I mean, it's a different place every day. There's some new catastrophe around the world as a result of these extreme weather events.
Let's slide a little bit into your new six-part video series on abrupt climate change. And one aspect that I've been stewing about is what seems to me the inevitable clash between climate-driven weather extremes and our need for more and more human food on this planet. What are you seeing?
For quite a while, I've been saying we're in a climate emergency. And the reason I've been saying that is because there's a huge threat to our global food supply. Up to now, we've had events in various countries. You know, for example, in 2010, the heat wave in Russia basically ruined 40% of their grain crop. They had to import that year. Arab Spring happened as a result of shortages. Australia is, you know, under huge drought, and their wheat growing areas are being pushed off the continent. This year, they had to actually import wheat grains from Canada because their crop basically failed. You know, of course, the U.S. with the trough stuck over over North America this last winter, making it very cold, but with lots of snow. You know, a trough is a low-pressure area, stormy, so lots of snow, huge snowpacks on the ground, and, of course, it melted, saturating the ground, and now the troughs have continued, and we've had this torrential rain situation, massive flooding, of course, record levels of rivers. So this has affected crops in a number of ways. The first thing is, because of the Trump tariffs, they were storing a lot of soy and other things. And, you know, when the grain elevators got flooded, the soy would absorb the water, just expand and explode out the grain elevators. So they lost about 30% of the crops that they were storing, you know, and they stored record amounts because of the tariffs. So the next thing is that the crops that were already planted in the winter were in the ground, and they basically were rotting in the ground. There was very little yield from those crops, from the winter planted crops. And, of course, they haven't been able to plant. Planting has been delayed because the ground is just too wet. I mean, maybe they should be thinking about planting rice in those flooded fields, right? But anyway, so the planting hasn't happened. And if that continues, there's definitely going to be food shortages, global food shortages, I think, because Europe is also under a very cold conditions, a sharp trough coming down there, lots of rain. So their crops are horrible as well. And China has a blight. There's a pest that is affecting their crop yields. You know, it's not clear how serious that blight will be if it's very serious. And if planting continues to be delayed in the U.S., then we're looking at global food shortages. You know, in Canada, you know, we're a food producing nation for the world, and there's some areas in our plains that are under drought, and yields are very, very bad. And in fact, because of this trough, I think it actually snowed a few days ago in Saskatchewan in some places. So all around, it's not looking good for food supply for the world.
Meanwhile, we're getting smoke in our skies from the great fires in northern Alberta, and it's always ironic that these fires are happening around an oil producing, the tar sands area. But those are massive fires, and the smoke is covering a big area, and that also changes the way plants grow and agriculture in other areas.
Yes, the fires and the resulting smoke can actually block out quite a bit of the sunlight on regions where the smoke is, and it can cause a cooling at the surface. I mean, the smoke particles are just like the aerosols that are responsible for the global dimming. And a while back, I did a series of videos on this new phenomenon where the fires are burning so strongly, they're so hot, and there's a huge convective uplift from the fires, and it can create and generate these massive clouds that look very similar to cumulonimbus thunderstorm clouds. They're called, basically pyrocumulonimbus clouds. So fire is creating the weather, and then the problem is these type of storm systems are a bit different. There's more chance that they're not going to be producing water, actually, but they'll produce the lightning. So you get lightning, and that's setting fires a long distance away from the original fire. And we're also getting phenomena like firenados, where the convective uplift from the fires are so hot that the airflow upwards from them, hot air rises. The hotter it is, the faster it'll rise, and it's getting this rotation and getting these firenados, and then they're tossing burning embers up to 5 kilometers away from the initial fire, and stuff is even carried higher and then dropped miles away. So I think after the Fort McMurray fire a few years back, there were fires started about 22 miles away. A fire ignited, and it was, some burning embers that went up and came down and ignited the fire, or it was lightning from the huge pyrocumulonimbus cloud that ignited the fire. So this is a huge problem. Firefighters are having difficulty knowing how to fight these fires. In fact, I posted a video of a fire truck, basically, with one of the huge hoses, and the hose was actually sucked up into one of these firenados, and the firemen are all trying to pull it back down. It's like they're flying a kite or something. It's just crazy stuff happening.
This is the stuff of disaster movies, and you'd think Hollywood wrote the script, but we've just not seen things like this on Earth before during human times. And then we have the inevitable pressure of longer and harsher heat waves building in future years. And as you pointed out, it's not that far off. Just last week, northern India went over 50 degrees C. That's 122 degrees Fahrenheit. They were pouring water on the roads, trying to keep them from melting. Farm animals and people keeled over dead. And yet hardly anyone in Europe or North America even heard about it. But the big heat is not that far off, is it?
No, it's not. And, of course, the India situation is, you get those high temperatures, at least the humidity. The monsoon is late in India. The monsoon should be coming, and that should cool things off a bit. But it hasn't arrived there yet. And, one of the problems is when you do get, lots of humidity in the air, you just need 35 degrees Celsius and 100% humidity. And basically, you're not able to sweat. You can't, you'll die outside in about, 6 to 8 hours, basically, even sitting in the shade outside. The body just can't reject heat. So there's some interesting products that I think will become very popular soon. And that's, I call it the chill suit, where you actually wear some clothing which circulates a liquid, or it has thermoelectric coolers, and it can cool your body directly, be battery powered in the case of the thermoelectric cooler, and allow you to be outside and to have your body cool. And MIT is just working on this device. Also, there was a report about it recently about cooling the body. I mean, think of it. I mean, we cool an entire room with air conditioning. If we can, have a suit or something, call it a chill suit, where people can individually cool their bodies, that would be a lot cheaper energy-wise than cooling an entire room for people.
Oh, my God. Little Billy, don't go outside without your chill suit. You might die. Okay, so the it's terrible.
Yeah, and then we'll add, we'll add an oxygen mask soon to it, too, plus a particle filter, right? I mean, breathing all that smoke is horrible. In fact, I've heard of people in, Western Canada that are sealing an individual room, and putting filter systems so that, when there is a wildfire and the whole town is engulfed in smoke, they can go into this room and breathe fresh, purified air.
Well, I've already been there twice, right here where I live. I've got HEPA filters and the house is totally sealed off. You don't open a door or window. It's unreal. Now, the Guardian newspaper and the New York Times also just covered new science about thousands of heat deaths expected in cities like New York and Los Angeles every year by 2050 if the climate heats up by 3 degrees C. Is that possible? Could we see thousands of people dying even in North America and Europe?
We've already had glimpses of that in, of course, the European heat wave, in 2003, I believe it was, there were something like 70,000 people died. Now, it was mostly older people who, air conditioning was very rare in a lot of those places, and people were just overcome by the heat. But there's been some similar intensity heat waves since then, and the fatality rate is much lower, because there's cooling centers, there's community centers where older people know to go and to stay hydrated and so on. In Montreal, in Quebec, province of Quebec, in Montreal, just last summer's heat waves, there was, about 70 people reported to have been, died in the heat wave. Again, it's older people and younger people who, very young kids, they basically don't have the ability to sweat. So when they have a temper tantrum, their head turns completely red, their face completely red. And when they get too hot, overheated, the same thing happens. They can't reject the heat. So they're much more vulnerable to these heat waves, as are the older people, just can't deal with it. So I think the only reason the numbers weren't reported in cities like Toronto and Ottawa for heat deaths, last summer, is because the records are just too poor. I think those heat deaths probably occurred, but they're not. The public records for those heat deaths is far better and almost real time in Quebec. So we're already seeing this, and we're pushing the margins of what the human body can stand. So, people that have any underlying medical condition or are weaker to begin with, as you get older, your body's not as resilient. Those people are most at risk.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With me is Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith from paulbeckwith.net. And we are talking about the signs of abrupt climate change upon us. Our other guest this week, Paul, is meteorologist Richard Rood. Right during my interview with him, a new article by Richard popped up on the online site, The Conversation. He was writing about the Great Lakes in North America, which do hold one-fifth of all the fresh water in the world, and those lakes are going haywire in unexpected ways. Did you read that article by Richard, and what is your takeaway?
Yes, I did. I mean, the interesting thing about the Great Lakes is most of the water is, you can trace it back to the melting of the glaciers that covered North America. Of course, just a few years ago, when we had some of these persistent heat waves, the lakes were at record low levels. There just wasn't enough inflow into the lake, and the water temperature was higher than normal, so there was higher evaporation rates, so the lakes were all setting record low levels. People were very worried that lived along the shorelines, and their property prices would plummet, and, their docks and things were high and dry, and the smell of the algae on the shorelines was horrible. It was a detriment to live along the lake. And then, of course, in the last few years, we've had record high levels, and there's lots of flooding along the shorelines. Most notably was the Toronto Island. The people living on Toronto Island had to sandbag like crazy, and there was record flooding there. And, right now, the lake's almost two-thirds of a meter higher than it was in the previous record. So, you know, we're breaking records year in, year out. And same thing with the, you know, the rivers feeding in. Of course, Ottawa, in the last 2 years ago, we had the flooding. And then September 21st of last year, we had the swarm of tornadoes. And then this year, we've had the record flooding surpassing that of 2 years ago, and we've had our tornado, you know, just on the weekend. So no city is unscathed. So of course, the Great Lakes are an enormous supply of water to millions upon millions of people. And they're also cooling nuclear plants that are on the shoreline. So as water temperature rises and as the, you know, lake level fluctuates, it can be very problematic to this power generation.
Well, I think this is further proof of what you said earlier, that as soon as a bad pattern seems to set in, we think, oh my God, is this the new normal now under climate change? But there isn't a new normal, and that's the story.
Yeah, there isn't. If you're on a trajectory that's pretty flat or slightly rising, you can sort of, you know what to expect. But if you're on a trajectory which suddenly becomes a vertical line, you don't have to move very far in the X direction to have a massive change, you know. And we're on this line or curve almost vertically going upwards. And so all bets are off, you know, until we end up at an area that's a bit more stable. And that area, the region, the stability that we're heading to is a much warmer planet with really bizarre, weak, fractured jet streams and, you know, much more monsoonal, torrential rain patterns on the land. I mean, we're already seeing it.
Well, we can't talk about extreme weather without covering the 45 days of constant storms, weird ones, running from Texas to the Northeast. It was floods, hail, tornadoes, the works. How is that climate related, though?
Yes, well, you know, it's got climate written all over it. So what happens is some of the big factors that affect the location of these storms and their severity is the first factor is the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico is very, very warm water, much warmer than usual. So there's lots of evaporation, and the winds carry this moisture-laden water from, you know, hot, loaded with water vapor, and it carries it up northward, up into, you know, the southern U.S. But this meets the second factor, which is the very hot, dry air coming down from the Rockies. It undergoes adiabatic expansion as it comes down. It's not doesn't have moisture in it. So you get very, very hot, dry winds that are moving from across the desert. And they basically meet this Gulf of Mexico humid air in what we call the dry line. And this dry line can run almost a north-south line where the air meets, because the air doesn't want to mix. It takes energy to... So as the air comes towards each other from both regions, it starts moving northward, and it creates this dry line. Now, what we had this year is the jet stream being so far south in this trough is the third factor. So it's bringing very cold air, also dry, downwards. And where these three things intersect, watch out. There's incredible amounts of energy, or we call it CAPE, convective available potential energy. So because of the temperature difference and the moisture difference and stuff, we get this clash of all, you know, huge temperature differences, huge humidity differences, and all the factors are there. The jet stream is moving very fast, can cause the shear, so the wind is moving faster as you go higher up. And it spins up all of these mesoscale convective complexes or massive, massive storms, but combines these massive cumulonimbus clouds into massive trains of storms. And then as the jet stream moves and the storms move and spin up, they're just throwing off tornadoes left, right, and center. Yeah, this is basically what's been happening. And over time with climate change, I think I've already pointed out in some previous shows and certainly in a number of videos how basically, Tornado Alley seems to have been shifting to the east and also northward. So, you know, if you look at the spread of these storms, almost 1,000 tornadoes in the last few months, you can see that they're spread very far eastward. They're not concentrated just in Tornado Alley. They're spread across lots of the U.S. And we don't have the, you know, we've got very good warning systems in Tornado Alley when a tornado is coming, but systems are much worse much slower and not needed as you move eastward. So people aren't ready for them. They haven't seen these things, you know. And by the end of the summer, of course, they were coming up into Canada last year. And already, you know, we've been seeing, I mean, tornadoes in Ottawa, June 2nd. I mean, this is unheard of. So everything is shifting, like all bets are off. But it's not a new normal, like new to undergo abrupt change. It could get a lot worse, the tornadoes, or they could shift location, or, you know, maybe some conditions are such that they become very quiet again or something. I mean, there's no new normal. I mean, there's whiplashing from, you know, torrential rains and flooding one year to drought another year, back again. There's no new normal, and it's kind of, you'll notice most meteorologists are going bald. I mean, they're pulling out their hair because their forecasts are terrible because the system has changed. So their analogs of what they expect to happen becomes much harder to predict for them.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left here together, so I know one of your specialties is the Arctic. If you'd like to talk about that, please go ahead.
Yeah. The melting in the Arctic is very concerning this season because, I mean, the ice is so thin and fractured and broken up, and it's on the move. If you look at some of the satellite images, if you go to Google Arctic sea ice graphs, you know, and look at all of the real-time data, it almost looks like the whole ice sheet in the Arctic is pulling away from shorelines towards the, you know, north of Alaska in the Barents Sea area. And, you know, it looks like the whole thing is on the move. And there's huge export of ice this year, broken, fractured ice, both through the Fram Strait between Greenland and Svalbard, you know, down to Iceland. There's huge infiltration of ice through the Nares Strait and into the Canadian Archipelago Islands because the ice, there's no ridging there. You know, the ice is thin throughout. You know, I think we're heading, all the ingredients are there. You know, the temperatures are much higher than normal in the atmosphere, and the wind pattern and such are conducive to a year where we have record melt. So it seems pretty clear, unless something changes, that we're going to greatly exceed the minimum sea ice year of 2012. You know, one of these years, we're just going to see the ice here today, gone tomorrow. You know, we're just going to see the whole basin cleared out with resulting in great increase in warming. You know, no ice in the Arctic Ocean, and the warming just skyrockets because you lose that latent heat effect, which keeps the temperatures about zero where the ice is melting, or the freezing point where both water temperatures and air temperatures above. So everything's changing. I mean, the ice is going to be swept out of the Arctic and be completely gone come 1 September, and with, you know, very likely within the next 4 or 5 years. You know, that's what the trends are all pointing at anyway.
And when your freezer breaks down, you got to throw all the food out because everything melts. So that's no good. From Ottawa, Canada, we've been speaking with our in-house climate scientist, Paul Beckwith. Paul takes you through every step to understand the latest climate science and current extreme weather in his videos. So be sure and visit his fabulous YouTube channel. I also really like his website, paulbeckwith.net. I check in there pretty regularly, and he's got a busy Twitter feed. And you should also hit that button to support his work. Thanks again, Paul. And as we often do, I hope to get your summer report when we kick off a new season next September.
Okay, well, thank you. So I have to run off to my 3-hour oceanography lecture. I'm teaching at University of Ottawa.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for sticking with Radio EcoShock. I know the rolling truth about climate and our broader environment can seem hopeless at times. We depend on scientific truth and developing harsh realities to drive our neighbors, countries, and our species toward survival instead of mass suicide. I think we can still enjoy living. With that cheerful thought, thank you for listening and caring about our world. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, the weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tune in, turn on.
Scientist tells people the truth. When times are good, When the truth offers no threat, people don't mind. But when times are very, very bad, well, a magician tells people what they wish were true.
Why is it taking so long? Can you explain it to me? Nobody can explain it to me. And don't tell me about all those damn winds again. Well, the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere get all mixed up and overlap. And I don't want to hear about that anymore. All I want to know is, if everybody was so smart, why didn't they know what would happen?
They did.
Well, I can't take it. I can take it. But it's unfair. It's unfair because I didn't do anything. And nobody I know did anything.